Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Yeshua Bengio to the broadcast. Yeshua is a pioneer of deep learning and is a full professor of the Department of Computer Science and Operations Research at the University of Montreal. He's also the director of the Montreal Institute for Learning Algorithms and a senior fellow of the Canadian Institute of Advanced Research. Yeshua serves as an advisor to a number of enterprises and is a co-founder of Element AI, a startup that helps organizations embrace artificial intelligence. He's the co-author of the book Deep Learning and more than 300 other publications. Yeshua earned a bachelor's degree in engineering and a master's degree in computer science and a PhD in computer science, all from McGill University. I recently caught up with Yeshua in his office in Montreal, Canada, and our conversation covered world-class IT Principle 1, people, as Yeshua described the importance of creating supportive and collaborative cultures, and Principle 5, external partnerships, as we discussed the ecosystems Yeshua has helped to develop to drive Canada's AI evolution. We also discussed the rapid progress being made with deep learning, the genesis and mission of Element AI, lethal autonomous weapons, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we would be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by TopTal, an exclusive network of the top freelance software developers, designers, and finance experts in the world. I recently caught up with TopTal CEO Tasso Duval, and he offered the following top five trends for hiring top talent.
The top five trends for hiring top talent are, one, hiring talent remotely, ensuring that they are able to work remotely and that companies are hiring talent remotely. Two, leveraging teams in different dispersed locations. If you're hiring in-house and you're leveraging remotely a bit, being open to having talent even in the same time zone is an important factor that we've noticed. Three, highly skilled teams becoming the majority rather than the lead, meaning ensuring that the team composition comprises of predominantly high-skilled labor rather than high-skilled labor supported by lower-skilled labor. Four, infrastructure being created to support those teams, ensuring that the teams in-house are connected with the remote teams that are working together. And five, flexibility with offer packages. We've seen that even the in-house talent that are joining companies from Google to Facebook and on are interested in demanding that there is a remote component to their job, whether it's one day a week or full-time, be included within their offer packages.
Yeshua Bengio, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT. It's a pleasure to speak with you. You have, number one, been involved in artificial intelligence for some time now, and I find it particularly intriguing how prescient some of the work that you've been doing has been. You, along with a variety of other colleagues like Jeffrey Hinton, Jan LeCun, have been working for some time in deep neural networks. And during the AI winter, this was an area that lost some of its funding and therefore lost perhaps a bit of its enthusiasm among the broader community. And now, actually, in more recent years, due to, among a variety of other things, but certainly the intersection of availability of data and the power of computing going up dramatically, it's potential has been more fully realized, obviously still in the process of advancing. And I wonder if we were to talk about the topic of neural networks, deep learning, where do you feel things have progressed to now? And I'd be curious about some of the things that you are most excited about in the near term in terms of its broader commercial implications.
First of all, we have made amazing progress, but I'd like to remind everyone that we are, according to me, very far from human level intelligence with computers. Most of the progress, to come back to your question, has been with what's called supervised learning, where machines have to be taught by essentially imitating humans, and humans have to provide the high-level concepts that a computer has to learn. And that can be tedious and limit the ability of computers to discover things by themselves. This ability for unsupervised learning, or what we call also reinforcement learning, when there is some feedback from the environment, is something that humans are very good at. But in terms of our research, we are still quite unsatisfied with, even though there's an amazing amount of recent work that's very exciting. That's one of the things that I'm working on. In particular, trying to combine unsupervised learning and reinforcement learning. Reinforcement learning is really when the learner isn't just passively observing the world or how humans are doing things, but actually interacting with some environment and getting feedback from it.
Great sort of overview there in terms of where things are and a bit more about the how do you foresee the steps between now and what maybe, as you pointed out, many decades from now, the more fully realized version of unsupervised learning, as you put it? What are some of the things that need to happen in terms of the steps along the way?
First of all, we have to understand what we have in front of us with the current algorithm, their limitations. That's how science works, right? It's not just about building new things. It's about understanding the algorithms, understanding the phenomena that we're studying. And if you look at the kinds of errors that current deep learning systems, the best ones that are trained on millions or even billions of examples, the kinds of errors they make are telling us a lot about the sort of superficial understanding of the world or even some aspect of the world that they're trained on. That's not something to be too discouraged about, because if you think about the kind of understanding of the world that, say, a mouse has or some animal has, it's also superficial. And we have a deeper understanding that allows us to survive better than these animals and actually trick those animals into things the same way that we are now able to trick those neural nets into producing the wrong answers. So how do we get beyond that? My vision has been for more than a decade to focus the research on the notion of learning better representations. That's at the heart of what deep learning is about. And in particular, representations that have this property that I called disentangles, that separates the different concepts, the different explanations. We call them factors in my jargon, that explain the data, that explain what the agent sees around it, that explain how the agent can control the world, that capture some of the causality that explain what we are seeing and what the computer is seeing. You know, I don't know what is the right steps in front of us. I have a program, but there's a lot of unknown. And one thing that's really important in research is to explore in many directions. That's the difference between basic research. It's long-term, it's exploratory, and more applied research where we are taking what we have and then we are sort of fine-tuning it to be able to build products, to solve more concrete problems. And that's also important because AI is having a huge impact in the world, whether it's commercial or in other ways, for example, in healthcare or potentially helping people in education and maybe agriculture or many other things where AI can have a huge impact on the world. I think both of these avenues are important, the long-term bets that we can make and taking advantage of the science that's been accumulated over the last few years and decades to make a big impact, positive impact on the world.
That's wonderful. On the commercial side, you've recently founded a new company called Element AI, which, as I understand it, aims to help companies who want to build AI solutions. I'm speaking very generally. I'd love to get more into the specifics as to how you do this. And I'm wondering what the genesis of Element AI was, and maybe you can talk a little bit more about its mission.
I have that dream that I could build here in Montreal a sort of international hub for AI, a new ecosystem, both scientifically and in terms of innovation that's really thriving in AI. And somehow the ball started rolling and it's happening. And part of that, of course, is to create companies that are going to do that. And one of the first ones has been Element AI. And it's occupying a very important niche because you have large multinational companies in particular that are not the Google, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, IBM, and so on, that don't have a team of scientists working on AI and are concerned, rightfully so, that their business could be transformed by AI in a way that, you know, if they're not part of it, they could lose out. So Element AI is helping them, is making spin-offs and business deals with them, and it's connecting them to local startups and companies as well. And another big element of Element AI is it's building a network of researchers, both internal and external, that are doing basic research in AI and machine learning, and deep learning especially, which is really important because, as I said, there's a lot in front of us in terms of research and progress. And there are issues that Element AI is focusing on, like what we call transfer learning. So for a new problem, we might not need as large a data set in order to get good results, taking advantage of what has been learned before on other data sets or other problems. And so it's creating this network of researchers in universities and within Element AI that is really free to explore, and at the same time helping the applied researchers at Elementi to be at the forefront of what's going on in the field for their applications.
Are there certain companies, certain industries that are particularly well suited, do you think, to be the clients of Elementi? Are there certain niches that you're hoping to address first?
The response from industry interested in Elementi could be giving has been amazing. I mean, there's basically more demands than the current team can handle. So a lot of what we're doing right now is recruiting new people. This is coming from pretty much all the sectors. So it's quite incredible. Right now, Elementi isn't focusing on one particular sector, but looking at the various opportunities and starting projects in many areas.
When an enterprise comes to you and comes to Elementi and is at the very beginning of their journey of getting involved in artificial intelligence, they know the concept, they're quite curious, obviously enough so that they've asked for a meeting and are thinking about perhaps investing. What are some of the things, generally speaking, that you advise in those early days for an organization to begin to ramp up on these topics?
The obvious building block is to come up with a strategy. And the strategy needs to be devised in a way that brings together the expertise from various aspects in the company, people who have the vision for the different products and where they could go in the future, you know, what the market in this particular niche, you know, might be pulling and asking for. And also the data side, of course, is clearly very important. You know, what data has been accumulated, what data could be collected, and finally, whether it makes sense from a deep learning point of view to tackle these problems, if there are solutions or if we can conceive of solutions in the, you know, in reasonable time that would potentially address these hard problems using the foreseen data that could be used for tackling these problems. It needs a meeting of the minds of people with different strengths and expertise within the company and within Elementi in order to come up with a number of recommendations. And for large companies, there could be a portfolio of these potential projects, of course, that will need to be prioritized and evaluated before an effort really gets going.
As I mentioned at the outset, you are also an academic. You are a professor Yes. at the University of Montreal, in addition now to being an entrepreneur. How do you divide your time? I think it's interesting in many ways, these are the two halves of what you described before. There's longer term, less immediate commercial applicable research that you're undertaking that is decades potentially in its vision versus those sort of shorter term commercial implications of what you're doing with Elementi. How do you divide your time between the two efforts?
My main job is academic. I'm 100% full-time at the university, and I advise Elementi, and I advise other companies as well. Even with the work that I do with Elementi and other companies like Microsoft, for example, it's mostly about the long-term aspect. I'm not really into nitty-gritty of the commercial things. And that's my strength. So that's, you know, that's what I can offer. Also doing something really important, which is build a new institute that the MILA has become, which is the heart of the AI ecosystem here in Montreal. And that brings together the researchers at my university, Université de Montréal, and McGill University. Both machine learning groups are joining forces and this new institute, which is going to have a separate physical place where both will be working together.
This is the Montreal Institute of Learning Algorithms, MILA?
That's right. We already have about 200 people in the MILA, bringing together the two universities. And we expect to double the number of professors and students over the next 2-3 years. So it's like a startup, right? It's a big thing. It's taking a lot of my energy these days.
It's exciting. And in many ways, a lot of what you've discussed, whether it's MILA, whether it's Elementi, is about building an ecosystem. It seems that especially with mm-hmm. a topic like artificial intelligence and some of the more specific areas that we've already described, having a good ecosystem of people surrounding you, people who are permanent partners, but also people who are temporary partners as well, becomes that much more important. Can you talk a little bit further about how you foresee this sort of ecosystem that you're developing?
The community aspect is really important. I believe that a lot of the success that we've had here in terms of research in Montreal is because of the particular culture that has been developed in my lab, MILA, over the years, a culture that really puts people, and here it's researchers, but I think it's something that can be done and more generally at the center stage. The people with our expertise are in such demand that we have to treat them like gold. Right? We have to really give them the freedom and let them find their place in the community so that they can be as motivated as they can to contribute to it and bring something with their own talent. And I think this is also where things should go at the larger scale of the whole city's AI ecosystem. There's something that's nice about the Quebec culture, which is maybe less individualistic than in the rest of North America and more towards, you know, how can we work together to build something together and collaborate and maybe have less of the competition nature and more of a building together flavor.
That is a nice segue to a topic I wanted to mention. You've alluded to it a few times, your vision of making Montreal an artificial intelligence hub. And it is remarkable, and especially if you expand that out to Toronto as well, that Canada seems to be doing some very interesting and progressive things to attract AI talent. You started to talk about some of the unique aspects of Montreal, of the province of Quebec, more generally speaking. Why Montreal? Is something in particular about the climate or the relationship between academics, the city or province government, and the business community that has fostered the sorts of partnerships appropriate to help bring about this AI revolution that's happening there?
I think there are many factors, and you've named some of them, but I would say the most important factor is a very simple one. It's critical mass. My group was one of the first groups in the deep learning research, started essentially with the university trusting our vision and allowing us to recruit more professors in that field at a time when it wasn't yet popular. And then there's a kind of snowball effect. Better researchers bring better students, better postdocs they get to publish better papers and then attract more international visibility. And then, you know, you can recruit even better people. And then when deep learning, you know, became a more of a commercial thing, it just attracted more companies here and investors. And once the ball got rolling on the commercial side, it just accelerated and accelerated. And of course, the coming of large companies like Microsoft, like Google last fall, and then now Facebook and probably other companies as well here is making Montreal even more visible in the scientific community as well as the investors community. But this has also stimulated entrepreneurs and so on. So for example, there's more and more of my students that want to start companies. And so they're starting companies here. Investors who used to ask the entrepreneurs to come to the Valley now are quite happy with them staying in Canada. This is something new, right? And as you mentioned, it's not just Montreal. You know, Toronto is moving very, very fast on this similar track. And we have created a collaboration between the Vector Institute in Toronto and the MILA in Montreal, as well as AMI, which is a machine learning center in Edmonton in Alberta. And the three of us together are really forming what we call an AI consortium for Canada, which is working both at putting Canada on the map scientifically, but also as sort of the center of the world, the country for AI. We are a small player, of course, compared to the US and China, but we have a critical mass, which is making a big difference. You know, Silicon Valley isn't a big place in terms of numbers of people. It has been a center for innovation because of this critical mass effect.
I wanted to talk to you a bit about AI safety. Elon Musk was tweeting about the worry that AI may lead to World War III. And there are a number of leading entrepreneurs and academics who have highlighted the potential threats of artificial intelligence, if not sort of harnessed appropriately. And I'm curious where you stand on this. How much of a worry is it for you as you see artificial intelligence advancing?
I'm not very worried about the Terminator scenarios of AI taking over humanity, although I think, you know, it's good that some people are investigating those issues, but they're really far away. What I'm more concerned about are short-term and medium-term potential concerns with the application of AI. So AI could be misused. And as you mentioned, one of the most concerning one is in the military sector. And there's a lot of support in the scientific community now for an international treaty banning lethal autonomous weapons, LAWs, as we call them now. And the issue is now being discussed in the UN. You know, serious discussions are taking place, and some countries are starting to push this. And of course, some militaries, like the US military, is trying to block that. But I think it's a big mistake. I think that if we allow these weapons to be commercialized easily is going to be bad for everyone's security, including, you know, the U.S., because it's going to make it easier for small players to use those tools. I think it does make sense to do military research on defensive techniques against lethal autonomous weapons. But I would like to see an international treaty that stigmatizes the use of these weapons in the same way that we've succeeded over the last few decades to stigmatize the development of nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, biological weapons, and landmines. I think it's exactly in the same line of thought that even though we may not be able to perfectly and tightly, you know, prevent those things, if we can reduce them by making it clearly immoral for everyone, including countries and large companies, to develop them, we can greatly reduce the security risk for everyone on Earth.
I'm also curious, if you don't mind my asking, in your own personal life, how AI has begun to impact it, the way in which you use your own technology. Where has technology taken over things that you used to do manually yourself? And maybe some of the things you're excited about in the near term, some of the changes that you foresee that might impact, of course, yourself as well as others.
As a user of technology, I'm not very different from most people. I still like to use pen and paper when I want to scribble equations and ideas. So, you know, it's there's something about this that I still need. In terms of where I see big changes in the short term, there's a huge potential coming with the progress we're making in deep learning for natural language. So in other words, how computers can do a better job to understand what is written, what is said, and also respond or generate natural language. That's something that's going to change completely the way we interact with computers. That's probably also going to have a big impact in terms of the job market, because so many jobs could be impacted positively or negatively by this. So this is something where many companies are investing heavily. That's another reason why I think there's going to be more progress. Scientific progress is very much proportional to how much effort you put in. So one of the reasons why deep learning has been so successful in the last 3 years is just because there are many more people doing it and doing research and then developing things with it. So that's going to continue.
Wonderful. That's a great vision. Yasuo Bengio, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT. It's been a great conversation.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be Neil Sample, the Chief Information Officer of Express Scripts, a $101 billion pharmacy benefit management company. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy-setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.